From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame holds its 15th annual induction ceremony on Monday. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from guitarist Scotty Moore, who will be inducted under the new category of Sidemen. He was Elvis's first guitarist and manager, playing with Elvis through the 60s. He'll tell us about playing on Elvis's first recording session. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The Romantics, the debut novel by Pankaj Mishra. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. GOP candidates George W. Bush and John McCain campaigned today in New York, hoping to garner the more than 100 delegates up for grabs in next week's Super Tuesday primary. McCain continued to try to link Bush to right-wing religious groups.
Do we want the ideas of Abraham Lincoln, of Theodore Roosevelt, of Ronald Reagan, or do we want the ideas of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Bob Jones? That's the choice that you have today, my friends.
The Bush campaign continued to accuse McCain of failing to vote for breast cancer research. Medicare has paid managed health care plans more than $4 million for patients who are dead, according to a new government audit. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Under Medicare rules, payments to HMOs for patients who die are supposed to end on the first day of the month after the death occurs. But an audit by the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services found that flawed payment and reporting systems have kept payments coming for as long as 7 years. The audit found Medicare has made a total of $3.1 million in improper payments to HMOs on behalf of 102 beneficiaries who died before February of 1994, and another $1.1 million for patients who died through September 1999. So far, Medicare officials have recouped about a third of the total. But the audit also found that unless further corrections are made, Medicare will continue to pay more than $1 million annually for the dead patients. Medicare officials say they're working to correct the problems. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of people in the Chechen capital, Grozny, desperately need humanitarian assistance. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN and private aid agencies are now doing an assessment of the convoy, which was a trial run. UN refugee spokesman Ron Redmond says they will decide next week whether more convoys will be sent to Grozny.
Judging from the initial reports from our monitors who accompanied this convoy, the needs inside Grozny are tremendous. The monitors describe a devastated and still insecure wasteland.
Redmond says only 21,000 civilians, mostly women, elderly, and children, remain in Grozny. He says bodies of civilian casualties are still being recovered from collapsed buildings. The UN delivered 45 tons of food to Grozny. Redmond calls this a drop in the bucket compared to the needs. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 202 points to close at 10,367. Advances led declines by 4-3 in heavy trading of more than a billion shares. The average price was up 60 cents. This is NPR News from Washington. A federal appeals court in Washington has upheld the Environmental Protection Agency's regulation requiring 19 states to take measures to control power plant pollution. The regulation is aimed at stopping pollution that drifts across state lines. In New York, the jury has concluded for the week in the trial of three New York City police officers accused of obstruction of justice in the 1997 assault on Haitian immigrant Abner Louima. Beth Fertig reports from member station WNYC.
they're considering only one charge, obstruction of justice. But after 3 days of deliberations, they're still unable to decide if Charles Schwarz and his two co-defendants lied to investigators to cover up Schwarz's role in the 1997 assault. Last year, Schwarz was convicted of helping fellow officer Justin Volpe sodomize Abner Louima with a stick in a station house bathroom. But Schwarz claims he's innocent and therefore had no reason to engage in conspiracy. During the trial, the jury heard testimony from more than 20 witnesses, including Justin Volpe. He said Schwarz was not present during the assault, but the government presented phone calls and testimony from investigators to prove its claim that the officers concocted a story to protect one of their own. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig, reporting from Brooklyn Federal Courthouse.
A teenage computer hacker in New Hampshire is reportedly denying that he had anything to do with last month's attacks on major internet sites. The young man was identified as 17-year-old Dennis F. Moran of Wolfboro, New Hampshire. Moran, a high school dropout who's unemployed, admitted to FBI agents that he gained unauthorized access to several websites, but he told the Associated Press he was joking when he claimed responsibility for the attacks that overwhelmed sites such as Yahoo and eBay. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will hold its 15th annual induction ceremony on Monday. This year, they're introducing a new category, Sidemen. One of the five inductees in this new category is Scotty Moore, the self-effacing musician who was Elvis's first guitarist and first manager. Moore played with Elvis from 1954 through the 60s. As Peter Guralnick, author of the definitive biography of Elvis, writes, guitar players of every generation since rock began have studied and memorized Scotty's licks, even when Scotty himself couldn't duplicate them. I spoke with Scotty Moore in 1997, after the publication of his memoir, That's All Right, Elvis. An Elvis box set called Platinum had also just come out, collecting 77 previously unreleased tracks. We started with a previously unreleased take of Laudie Miss Claudie. Listen for Scotty Moore solo.
D2WB1293, take
tell,
one.
Tell my band, my. Yeah, something like that.
Well, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudia, gal, you sure look good to me. Well, please don't excite me, baby. No, it can't be me. Because I give you all of my money, gal, but you just won't treat me.
Before Scotty Moore recorded with Elvis at Sun Records, Moore recorded at Sun with his own country band, the Starlight Wranglers. That's how he got to know the owner and mastermind of Sun Records, Sam Phillips.
But we became great friends through that connection. And the job that I had, I was off early in the afternoon. And if Sam wasn't working in the studio or something, I'd go by and we'd have coffee next door to a little cafe there, and just discuss the business in general. Have you heard so-and-so and the record they've got out and the way they're doing it and different sounds? And Sam was always saying, well, if we can just find something different, we can find that little niche, you know, to get in between all this other stuff that's happening. And Marion, his secretary, was having coffee with us one day, and she said, Sam, what about that boy was in about a year ago and cutting that estate for his mother? And Sam said, yeah, best I remember, he had a pretty good voice. And that's all I needed the next couple of weeks. I said, you contact that kid yet? Blah, blah, blah. And finally, I guess he got tired of that, and he told Marion, said, said, take that guy's number and name out of the file and give it to Scotty. And he turned to me and said, give him a call and get him to come over to your house and see what you think about it. And, of course, I did. And that was on a Saturday. I called him. He came over on Sunday afternoon. And we spent, I guess, a couple of hours. Seems like he knew every song in the world.
Well, when you asked him to come over and do some songs for you, what songs did he sing?
Everything. I mean, he did Billy Eckstine, he did Eddie Arnold. I don't remember a specific song necessarily, but I mean, he just knew all these songs.
And did he do them in the style of the singer who had the hit version?
Yes.
So he was singing in a lot of different voices.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have a sense of what voice was really his?
No, because he would, at his age, he still didn't have that timbre yet.
Oh, the deep voice.
The deep voice.
So musically, you thought he was versatile, but you couldn't tell who he was.
That's fair to say. And in fact, after he left that day, I called and relayed that basic information to Sam. I said, as you remember, you told us to go out and get some original material. And he said, well, he said, I'll tell you what, I'll call him and get him come in and for an audition and said, just you and Bill Black come in. I don't need the whole band, just need a little, just a little noise behind him. So the next night we went in, which was the audition, and then we were taking a break, and is when the thing exploded, Elvis just jumped up and started just frailing his guitar and singing "That's All Right, Mama," just nervous energy.
Now that was a song by Arthur Crudup.
Yes.
Did you know the song when he was starting to play it?
No, I'd never heard it.
So you just started to fill in behind him,
right?
Not
Bill,
knowing the song.
Bill started just slapping the bass and it sounded pretty good what they're doing. So I started in just playing some kind of rhythm thing with him too.
And then Sam Phillips, the head of Sun Records, liked it and asked you to lay it down on tape.
Yeah, he was in the control room, but the door was open, and when we was doing it, and he came, stuck his head out there, said, "What are you guys doing?" And we said, "Just goofing around," you know. He said, "It sounded pretty good through the door. Said, let's put it on tape, see what it sounds like." And we made a couple of cuts, and he listened back and made some changes and stuff. And the best I remember is only like maybe four or five
takes?
Takes, yeah. We might have stopped if, Elvis got too close, popped the mic or something of that nature. But it just seemed like it didn't take but a few minutes to do it. Or at least it feels like that now.
Well, let's hear the version that was actually released of That's All Right. Elvis Presley, my guest, Scotty Moore on guitar.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Well, Mama, she done told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you foolin' with, she ain't no good to you. But that's all right, that's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway do.
When you recorded this, Scotty Moore, did you have any sense that this was something new and exciting that was happening? This was the beginning of something important.
All of us knew when we listened to it that it was different. But we didn't know what direction, because it was a R&B song and with their instrumentation kind of threw it into more of a country flavor, so it was a mixture. And
what you're playing there is really very jazz influenced.
Well, yes and no. I'm trying to. I had just begun, had been turned on to Chet Atkins with his thumb finger playing a few months back, and I was had been trying to figure out how he did that. It sounded like two guitars, and I was beginning to understand it, but I couldn't do it. But then I started doing the rhythm thing on this to just try to fill it up. And as with three or four takes went on, I kept trying to stab little notes in as I was doing the rhythm.
Those little high notes that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, those high notes that you play in the fills are so unexpected in a rhythm and blues song, I think.
Yeah, they would have been, right.
They're kind of delicate for that.
Sneaky.
Sneaky. I like that. That's interesting, too, that here's, you know, this like really early rock and roll record. There's no drummer on it.
No.
I mean, well, you know, drums are like the backbeat of rock and roll and everything, and you're starting off without a drummer.
Well, it was, like I said, number one, it was an audition on the first thing, but even after that, well, Sam used the Bill Slap, and then he would add the tape delay on top of that, which gave it a rhythmic thing also. But he always said, oh, he hated drums. And when I got a little more in tune...
Sam Phillips was saying he hated drums?
But... after I got a little more into the engineering savvy, it was a small, this room's not much bigger than this. He couldn't control them. That's why he didn't like them.
Now, what were your thoughts about Elvis's guitar playing?
He was a wonderful rhythm player as far as, you know, as an acoustic open type rhythm. I had great rhythm and had great rhythm in his voice. If you listen, he did a lot of things with the voice. It just came natural to him. I think he got that through the gospel influence, you know, the well, well, wells and the that type thing, especially the bass singers would do in gospel music.
Now, tell me the truth. After you started recording with Elvis, did you think, this guy's a great singer, or were you thinking, this guy's okay?
Oh, well, we became more aware after just three records that he liked a challenge, but... He was very particular about songs. He had to get into them, feel them good. Now, true, most of the stuff on Sun wasn't original material. There were remakes of R&B and some couple of country things like Milk Cow Blues and things like that. But when we went to RCA, things changed. He was absolutely picking his own material in. And we'd go into the session and have a stack 2 feet high of acetates. In the first couple of hours, he would spend going through those, and he might listen to 8 bars and zap across the room. Then he'd listen about halfway, and he'd put that in another stack to come back and listen to again.
These are what, demos that had been made for
demos,
him?
Right. And that's the way he did it. And very few times did I ever see him, that one he had kept in the maybe stack, then that we would actually try, that he would then throw it away after he heard it back. He had that good a ear.
Do you have any say in it?
The only thing that he didn't, let us do whatever we wanted to, as far as putting the song together musically.
Do you remember one of the songs that was picked out of the demo pile like that?
I think Don't Be Cruel was picked like that. Of course, Hill and Range could try to keep their main writers and what they thought at the top of the stack, too, you know.
My guest is Scotty Moore, Elvis's first guitarist. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Standing alone without a dream in my heart, without love of my own.
Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Scotty Moore, who was Elvis's first guitarist. No, you ended up booking and managing Elvis in the early days of his recording career when he first got started at Sun Records. This was, I think, at Sam Phillips' suggestion. What did that mean? What was the work you were doing?
Well, yes, I was doing that, trying to book some jobs. But the management thing, there were, when the Dewey Phillips started playing the record in the...
Dewey Phillips, the Memphis DJ, who broke Elvis's first record on the air.
And it was breaking like crazy around Memphis. And there were two or three, quote-unquote, promoters, bookers, that started calling Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't know, you know, he didn't know what to tell them or anything. And, and we were talking about it at the studio one day. And it was actually Sam's idea. He said, tell you what. He said, Elvis, why don't you sign a contract with Scotty for a year as your personal manager? That way you will not have to lie. Because he didn't feel comfortable about dealing with that stuff. And so that'll give us all time to find somebody that we all like and think we can work with. And that was Bob Neal, who was a local disc jockey. And he started booking us all through Mississippi, Arkansas. And then you know who came into the picture and just gradually eased Bob on out.
Talking about Colonel Parker. Did you actually have to do any of that booking yourself early on?
Yes, I did quite a bit. First, I'd say 6 months or so, yeah.
So tell me what was like early on before people really knew who Elvis Presley were when you were trying to establish dates.
It was rough. I mean, you know, we're talking about making, for the group, you know, $25 a night,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe driving 50 miles.
How would you describe what Elvis and the band were doing to someone who if you were trying to book yourselves into a place where they hadn't heard you yet?
Oh, but it was almost impossible if they hadn't heard the record on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did you describe it? Here's this kid going to come out in a pink pants and white stripe and white buck shoes and... and a New York duck haircut in Mississippi. Now, we tried to find places that they at least heard heard him on radio or something. And then even then, when they saw him, it was kind of shock value, you know.
What was the first time like when you saw him that way?
It didn't bother me, but that the Sunday I was telling you he came over to the house.
Mm-hmm. This is before you recorded.
Yeah. And my wife was there, and she kind of gave me the jaundice eye, and I thought she was going out the back door when she saw him.
Well, how was he dressed?
He had on a white lace see-through shirt, and it was either black or pink slacks with a white stripe down the side. And it was just unusual for the norm, but he always loved those flashy clothes and stuff like that.
Let me play another record from the Sun Sessions, and I thought we'd play Mystery Train.
Hey, good. That's my signature song.
Yeah. So, tell me a little bit about what you're playing on this and what it was like to record this track. Share some memories about it.
It was a slow R&B song.
That Junior Parker had
Junior
recorded
Parker
before.
Had, yeah, and we ended up just getting the tempo up more, and I changed the rhythm thing around and. I've always loved it. It's just a fun thing to do. I still use that as playoffs and stuff on things I do.
Now, did you and Bill Black work out the rhythm on this, or was this a groove that you just happened into together?
Well, Bill would just naturally, he was naturally fall in, slap bass, and, you know, put the rhythm in there. He might not hit every note dead on, but that rhythm would always be there. We always went for feel.
Mm-hmm.
If it felt good, if it was some little bobble or something, note wasn't quite true or something, it didn't matter. Because once you get that feel and you keep trying, it'll just go downhill. You reach that peak and it's gone.
Okay, well, this is Mystery Train. Elvis Presley, my guest, Scotty Moore on guitar.
Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is guitarist Scotty Moore, who we just heard on Mystery Train, and he's written a new autobiography called That's All Right, Elvis. When did you start realizing that Elvis was really catching on in a very emotional way with his fans?
I would say that after we did the first couple of TV shows with Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey,
mm-hmm.
after we went to RCA, before that, most of our shows and stuff had been all in the Southeast, and there had been some, granted, that starting to see the hysteria and so forth, but it really didn't come home to us till we did those shows, that national exposure. Then it just seemed like the floodgates opened up, you know.
Now, how did you feel about this? On the one hand, it was like really good news for the group that the singer was so popular. On the other hand, he was getting so much of the attention. Did you feel envious of the attention that he was getting?
Oh, no, that never even crossed our minds. No, that we hope would mean bigger paychecks, bigger paydays, you know, for everybody.
Did it?
No. No, it did grow a little bit, but not very much. That's kind of what I'm saying with the title of the book. The pay raises, the perks and stuff, as it got bigger and bigger, didn't come along for the band, and I'm just saying that's okay. It's not we were being paid a fair wage as far as a man on the street with everyday job.
Right.
You know, $200 a week back then wasn't bad at all. But then you take, as he got bigger and we had to get in these bigger hotels, and people expect you to take them to dinner, and we bought our own clothes and paid our own hotel bills out of what we were making. We were saying, you know, hey, something should come from some other source, you know. And that was the thing. We weren't really arguing about that we didn't have enough to pay the bills at home, but it was all this other stuff that was really expected of you that you couldn't afford.
Scotty Moore, recorded in 1997. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. On Monday, Scotty Moore will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the new category, Sidemen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Turner Classic Movies, presenting 31 Days of Oscar. Tomorrow night, Marlon Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House and its Harmony Books division, publisher of How to Know God, The Soul's Journey into the Mysteries of Mysteries by Deepak Chopra, M.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Scotty Moore, Elvis's first guitarist, and Maureen Corrigan reviews The Romantics, the debut novel by Pankaj Mishra.
I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, my hands are shaky and my knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own two feet. Who do you think of when you have such luck? I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, please don't ask me what's on my mind. I'm a little mixed up, gonna feel fine when I'm near the girl that I love best. My heart beats so it scares me to death when she touches my hand. What a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano and it's hot. I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. My tongue gets tied when I try to speak. My insides shake like a leaf on a tree. There's only one cure for this body of mine. That's to have that girl at a love.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, we're listening back to a 1997 interview with Scotty Moore, who was Elvis's guitarist from 1954 through the 60s. Moore will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on Monday in the new category, Sidemen. I spoke with him after the publication of his memoir, That's All Right, Elvis.
You moved to RCA with Elvis in 1956.
Right.
So what were some more of the changes that happened with the change of recording company when you moved from Sun to RCA?
Well, first of all, RCA was a, at that time, the studio was a big, huge room. But they had, although Sam was a technical guy also, but you know, you've got an engineer and you've got a guy running the tape machine and you got the producer sitting there and, you know, the way the big boys did it.
Mm-hmm. Did you like that change? Did it make you feel like more professional or less in control?
In some ways. They started out, it wasn't very long, probably the first session they found out, where if I had an intro and I flubbed the first note, then they'd punch in EWF, you know, take two. And they finally eased off with some of that stuff.
I mean, they were deciding wasn't good before you even started playing.
Right, and we weren't used to that kind of stuff.
Right,
you know,
right.
Let you get into the song and then mm-hmm. start mm-hmm. doing that.
Did it ruin your rhythm?
Well, it ruined your train of thought sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just get... But they adapted real quick. They still had take numbers, but they'd wait till we kind of got the song worked up and maybe got a few of the glitches out of the way. Then they'd start in with the take numbers.
What would you say is your most copied guitar solo from the Elvis records?
Hmm.
Or one of the most?
Probably Heartbreak Hotel, maybe. I don't know. I've never been asked that before. Can we do a survey? Write in, folks, and tell me. I don't know.
Well, why don't we go for Heartbreak Hotel?
Okay.
Tell me your memories of this session.
Well, of course, that was the first one on RCA. And they were trying to get basically the same sound that Sam was getting, had gotten with us in Memphis. And they had this big, long hallway out in the front that had the tile floor. So they put a big speaker at one end of it and mic at the other end and the sign, do not enter. And they used that. That's where it ended up with that deep, real room echo instead of the tape delay echo that Sam had used. Now, there is, it's hard to hear, there is a little tape delay on it, but either their tape machine didn't match his, so it's just very slight, and then they ended up with the acoustic echo. And I'll give them credit. They didn't, I don't think they knew, maybe they didn't think about it, but room echo at that point was sound effects they used in the movies. They weren't using them for recording. And then here comes this, and it's so drastic. But it worked for the song. When you say, you know, at the end of Lonely Street, and it's so distant. And I like to say this, if you don't mind, that in speaking of these technical things, one thing that Sam did that I don't believe he realized when he was doing it, and I didn't until years later, that I got into engineering, he pulled Elvis's voice back close to the music. You know, all the Sinatra and all those things where the voice is so far out in front. And he more or less used Elvis's voice as another instrument.
Into the mix.
Into the mix. But didn't bury him like a lot of the rock things, you know, later.
Right.
But you could still, but closer.
Now, your solo on Heartbreak Hotel, is that something you had prepared before the session, or is this something you had worked out?
No. Everything we ever did was just spur of the moment.
Did you learn the song at the session, or did you know it before that?
No, learned it at the session.
Well, all right, let's hear it. 1956, Heartbreak Hotel.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be so lonely, baby, so lonely, they could die. Now the bellhop's tears keep flowing, and the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on Lonely Street, they'll never, never look back and think you're so, think you're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely, well, they're so lonely, and they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down Lonely Street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be, because so lonely, baby. Well, you will be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die.
Heartbreak Hotel, my guest Scotty Moore on guitar, and he's written an autobiography, which of course includes his years playing guitar with Elvis Presley. It's called That's All Right, Elvis. Did you see Elvis undergo a personality transformation as he became more and more famous, you know, a recording star, a movie star, a heartthrob, an icon?
You know, the years I spent with him, he seemed to take it in stride.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw all the things changing around him, you know, with the movies and such. And he became more secluded as he gathered his entourage around him because he didn't feel like he could go out and didn't want to cause a scene, you know, and just going to, you know, like a famous restaurant or something. But as far as personality changes and stuff, I didn't become aware of any until after I left him, and then he started in the 70s. And I don't know the inside, and I've heard, of course, and read a lot of stuff, but it still amazes me because just a few months before he died, I saw some footage, and when he was so bloated, and I said, there's something desperately wrong. Because he was very vain, and there's no way that he'd go out in front of people like that.
Did you feel
I don't think he could see himself in the mirror at that point.
Did you feel like you didn't recognize the person he had become?
No, I didn't.
Did you communicate with him at all during that period?
No, and it was not because of any conflicts or anything. It's just that with this entourage around, and there was two or three of those guys that were really good guys, but still, he could call me a lot easier than I could get through to him. You know what I'm saying? You make the call, you know, if he ever gets it or not. And so I just left it for him.
But he did not call though.
You never know what he's being told.
Right. When did you stop playing with Elvis, and what was behind stopping?
Actually, the 1968 special, which now they call the comeback special.
That great TV special where he's wearing the leather jacket
and
the leather pants.
Right. he was an absolute Adonis on that show.
Mm-hmm.
He looked good. He was in great shape. And if that man had a pill in him at that point, well, I'd like for him to prove it to me. I mean, he was ready. He was nervous because when he found out he was going to have to, these two little groups they brought in when we did our in the round thing, that made him nervous. But he was anxious. He only had, I think, one more movie to finish before all the contracts were done. And he wanted to get back performing. That's where he was best at, what he loved to do.
Did you stop playing with him because of conflicts over money?
Not from the 68 point of view.
It was before that.
Bill and I left him at one point for about, I don't know, 6-8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But we went back. Mm-hmm. They called us back and worked on a per gig basis. They were just trying to get his attention, you know. They said, what strikes are all about in here?
Right. So that was a good concert for you, too, that TV comeback?
Yeah. And in fact, DJ and I had dinner with him at his house, and he did something that...
Is the drummer.
Drummer, yeah.
DJ Fontana.
Mm-hmm. And because that was always, regardless of who was around, if he wanted to say something to you, he never made any moans about go and whisper or anything like that. But that night he asked DJ and I to go back in another room with him. And he asked us, said, how would you guys like to do a European tour? We, of course, said, sure, just let us know. And he asked me, he said, do you still have your studio? And I said, yes. He said, what's the chances of getting in there and locking up for a couple of weeks? And I said, just give me some warning so I can block the time. I didn't tell him I was going to charge him for the time. And those two things never materialized. I have no earthly idea what he had in his mind about going in to the studio. Don't know.
It was Vegas after that.
And then management called all the Nashville players about Vegas. It was going to be a 2 or 3 week deal. Nashville was at its absolute peak. The Jordanaires alone had 40 sessions on the books with Owen Bradley. And we all got together. They made some pitiful weekly salary offer. And we all got together and said, well, all we can do is just make a counter offer and show them what we'd lose if we did it. And, of course, it was ridiculous for them out there. And next thing I knew, they headed into Vegas, and I just figured at that point that was the end of it as far as my side of it. And I still had a studio, so it was like official, well, I'm quitting playing today, but I just got into the studio work and just laid it aside, you know.
My guest is Scotty Moore, Elvis's first guitarist. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Elvis's longtime guitarist, Scotty Moore. When you stopped playing with Elvis, you virtually gave up the guitar for, I don't know, close to 25 years, I think.
24 years, right.
And I guess I can't understand that.
Well, after I sold my studio, then I started a tape duplicating company.
Mm-hmm.
And then also an industrial printing company. And so I was pretty busy. I mean, there really wasn't time for... thinking about playing. I sold all what guitars I had.
You created a life for yourself in which there wasn't time for playing, but you could have created a life for yourself in which there was no time for a tape duplication service because you were playing so much guitar. Did you try that?
No, I really didn't.
Was it because you didn't care about playing anymore, or did you make the assumption that there wasn't going to be a place for you?
Well, it really started when I had the studio. I mean, you're trying to draw people in, and you don't want to...
You didn't want to compete with the people you were recording?
Yeah, I didn't want them to be intimidated in any way. So I just kind of kept that, you know, in the background, unless somebody recognized me or something like that. I didn't push it to the forefront at all.
But even that, why did you want to run a recording studio instead of being on stage playing guitar?
I told somebody one time, they asked me the same thing. I said, well, shoot, why would I just play guitar? I can play the whole orchestra, you know.
So you really enjoyed being
behind
the controls?
Yeah, really did.
I guess it must have felt good to be in control, because in the band, you know, Elvis had more say than the musicians did, and in the recording studio there was people from RCA who were calling the shots.
You might be right. Don't mess with me, I'll turn you off. I'll hit the red button.
But you started playing again, what, in the early 90s, was it?
92.
Mm-hmm. And what was behind that?
Well, I'll have to back up a little bit there. About 2 years, 90. I went to a little gathering for Carl Perkins. Carl and I, of course, had known each other from Sundays. And if somebody else down there, and I think said, so why haven't you two guys ever recorded anything together? And actually, I had done one session with Carl in 75. He wrote a song with all Elvis song titles called EP Express. But other than that, we never had recorded anything together. And that's when this guy asked us, why don't you two guys record something? And Carl and I looked at each other and said, well, why not? And we talked about it a minute, and we said, okay. Well, lo and behold, just a few weeks later is when the throat cancer hit him.
Mm.
And he was laid up for like about 18 months with that. Christmas of 91, I believe. I called him just to see how he was doing. Well, it wasn't Christmas Day. It was, you know, during that period. And he said, Scott, you won't believe it. I just came from the doctor today and said they gave me a clean bill of health. And I said, well, does that mean we can go back and do this recording? And he said, yeah. Yeah, I said, we'll do that. And I said, but now look, I hadn't played in 24 years. He said, oh, said, you just like falling off a bicycle, you know, something like that. So in a sense, we was kind of, like, you know, pumping each other. And I think it was February of 92, we actually got together in the Old Sun studio and did something.
When you picked up your guitar about 24 years after you'd put it down to record with Carl Perkins, had you played it? I mean, did you remember how to play? Had you played at home in the interim?
No, I didn't even have any guitars.
Gosh. Can you tell me you didn't miss it those years?
I really didn't. Uh-huh. I've thought about that really hard. And I was so busy doing other things, I guess. Right. But the thing that really got me, when I realized it was in my blood, the Elvis celebration, August of that year, 92, I went to Memphis and did the show with Carl. And I'm standing over in the wings, Carl's fixing to bring me out, and I'm thinking to myself, you're supposed to be nervous. And I walked out and it just bothered me a bit. And I was really surprised. And that's when I told myself, it's in your blood. You might as well admit it.
Tell me, you know, in the years after Elvis's death, there have been cult groups that have risen around him, people who swear that they've seen him even though he's been dead and so on. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. What goes through your mind when you see the way even in death he is worshipped? I mean, you knew him as a man, not as a god.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't. They're misguided. You don't want to be sarcastic, say, you know, get a life, but it's okay to like somebody, but don't idolize them like that, you know. And he wouldn't have liked that. He really wouldn't. And he didn't like being called king either.
He didn't?
No. He said there was only one king, and there was a man upstairs.
Do you feel bad that Elvis died during a period when you weren't really in touch, so you didn't have a chance to maybe talk about things with him that you might have liked to talk about before he passed?
Well, yes, in one way, but in another way, he was so vain, I could never see him growing old gracefully.
Huh, that's interesting.
Oh.
But like you were saying, if he was so vain, and yet he managed to... allow himself to balloon the way he did.
That just astonishes me. Yeah. I don't know. I'll never understand that.
But you can't imagine an aging Elvis.
No, I mean, if he hadn't got into that
right.
situation, no, I never could. In fact, the guys, we used to talk about it, you know, said, what's he going to do when he gets about 60, you know? what if he goes bald, you know, just all kind of stuff like that.
Well, Scotty Moore, I'm really glad you're playing again. And a pleasure to have the chance to talk with you.
Terry, it's been a pleasure and enjoyable.
Scotty Moore, recorded in 1997. On Monday, he'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the new category, Sidemen. The other sidemen to be inducted are King Curtis, James Jamerson, Earl Palmer, and Hal Blaine. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the debut novel by Pankaj Mishra. This is Fresh Air. Pankaj Mishra is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and the Times Literary Supplement. In his first novel, The Romantics, he turns his critical eye toward literature and his native India. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Death by Reading. That could well be the subtitle of lots of novels, because so many of them are basically cautionary tales warning their readers against the danger of reading novels. Flaubert's Madame Bovary is the epitome of this kind of tale. A beautiful young woman escapes the tedium of her marriage by reading love stories. She takes their plots too much to heart, and poof, before you know it, her life is destroyed, all because of her libertine ways with a library card. The Romantics, an evocative first novel by Pankaj Mishra, is the latest entry in this literature-can-be-lethal subgenre. The chief casualty here is a likably earnest Indian college student named Samar. Rootless and eager to expand himself beyond his provincial Brahmin upbringing, Samar has traveled to the holy city of Benares, the place where mountains of corpses are cremated daily by the banks of the Ganges, and pilgrims bathe themselves in its holy water. Instead of immersing himself in the Ganges, however, Samar plunges into a rigorous program of heavy reading in Western thought. He dutifully makes his way through Schopenhauer and the criticism of Edmund Wilson, as well as, here comes trouble, the novels of Turgenev and Flaubert. An impressionable loner, Samar has all the symptoms of terminal bookwormitis. When he ominously declares in the opening pages of the Romantics that, I wanted to read and do as little possible besides that, he might as well be signing his own spiritual suicide note. Of course, like most authors, Pankaj Mishra has been infected by reading too, most obviously here by E.M. Forster and his anxious East meets West classic, Passage to India. The Romantics is a kind of updated riff on Forster's novel. In the intervals when Samar looks up from his books, he makes the perilous acquaintance of a group of expatriates, a middle-aged British spinster named, all too obviously, Miss West, some latter-day hippies searching for Indian enlightenment, and a beautiful French woman named Catherine, who ignites his Flaubert-fed fantasies. After he and Catherine sleep together, Samar thinks to himself, I had a growing conviction that after the dull, pointless years of drift, I had been predestined for the moment when I met Catherine, the encounter in which some of the richness of life and the world were revealed to me. That poor sap. He makes the terrible mistake all of us devoted readers are susceptible to. He imposes plots on his life, seeing climaxes and conclusions, when all he's really experiencing with Catherine is a minor blip on the flat line of his own solitude. In the way it mercilessly charts the reduction of Samar's life almost to the vanishing point, the Romantics reminded me a lot of the moody novels of Anita Bruckner, whose characters flail against but never break out of the prison house of self. All of this sounds depressing, but Samar is such a sweet, idealistic, and eloquent narrator, even if his insights are sometimes shaky, that his retrospective account of his misspent youth is compelling. And especially if you're curious about contemporary India, the Romantics conjures up vivid images of a country fixed in a state of chaos. Young people lucky enough to attend college, Samar tells us, exhaust their youth preparing for civil service exams, memorizing whole essays on Gandhi and Nehru, cramming their heads with arcane statistics about the Indian economy. Samar recalls waking up each morning in Benares to the sounds from nearby houses, radios blaring devotional music, wet laundry being slapped against the bathroom floor, the voices of people queuing up before the municipal tap in the alley below. He describes the naked pilgrims in that city, processing past coconut and flower sellers, watchful monkeys, and the ubiquitous rubbish. If you're into India, reading the Romantics will whet your wanderlust. If, like me, you find the thought of all that cow dung in the street off-putting, this novel probably will strengthen your conviction that it's preferable to stay home and just read about the place.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Romantics by Pankaj Mishra. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. That's Joel Forrester playing now. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From virtualrelocation.com, an online resource for moving and relocation, featuring cost of living comparisons and virtual city tours at virtualrelocation.com. And from Random House and its Harmony Books division, publisher of How to Know God, The Soul's Journey into the Mysteries of Mysteries by Deepak Chopra, M.D., This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, documenting war, conflict, and crisis, a talk with photojournalist James Nockway. His new book, Inferno, collects his photos from the past 10 years. Join us for the next Fresh Air.